Hi, I'm Michael Morgan, and welcome to this month's podcast, which looks at engagement in two very different settings. Roger Highfield looks at some of the ways in which the Science Museum engages and enthuses people in science. Chris Fleming from Go Science takes a different view in his role to bringing together academia and policymakers, and discusses the benefits of working more closely together.
Roger, welcome to Biz. Can you tell us why you were here to talk to staff today?
Well, I just made a very basic point that in the Science Museum Group, we have a huge informal learning effort that's reaching out to something like 600,000 young people every year. And we're not trying to replace conventional education. We're just trying to plant a spark of inspiration in their heads, to get them, to keep them interested in science, technology, and engineering. And we've got lots of ways that we can do it, but a really interesting, powerful way to reach out to that audience is to look at the sparks that can fly when you get artists and scientists working together on projects.
And are there any particular projects that you have in mind there? Are there any particular successes?
We've got lots and lots of examples where art and science have worked together. I should say, I don't see these as two cultures. They're very much poles of the same culture, one a kind of subjective end, one at the objective end. But let me give you a very concrete example. Climate change. We all care about climate change. We all want to know more. And you know what? We're all a bit bored with it as well. So we worked with Superflex on something called a cockroach tour, where you're giving, you know, it's a fun idea where we're making visitors, small groups of visitors, dress up as cockroaches. We're saying this is the most resilient creature on the planet. If there's a climate change disaster, they're going to last, you know, they're going to survive. And we're giving them an insight into the impact of climate change through the viewpoint of a cockroach. Sounds bonkers, but it was only supposed to run for a few months, and people absolutely love it. It's a big hit. It can be things like play. So Marcus de Sautoy is working with Complicité on X and Y, which is, you know, very intriguing, dramatic take on mathematics. It could be more straightforward collaboration. So we had David Hockney do an iPad portrait of Stephen Hawking for one of our exhibitions. We are going to launch a big thing called Media Space, where we're a showcase for our world-class photography collections in Bradford. Again, that's another way where I think the two poles of the culture are working together. I could go on and on. There's lots more examples.
What about the Higgs boson exhibition that's being planned for the autumn?
Well, Collider actually provides a really interesting example of where art, in this case West End Theatre folk and Finn Ross, the video artist, can actually help us deal with a real problem, which is that when you've got the biggest machine on the planet, that's as big as the Circle Line, which has got eyes around it, in effect, which are detectors at about, you know, four or five stories tall. We can't drag those over to South Kent and put them in the Science Museum. But what we can do is we can work with Finn Ross, the video artist, to come up with a kind of impressionistic experience for the visitor, where they get the sense of what it must feel like at the heart of one of these massive detectors when two particles collide, and then you get showers of subparticles and insights into the Higgs and so on. I think that's a really great example of where art can help us solve a very real problem.
You have partnered with Biz recently on the Great British Innovation Vote. How well do you think that went?
I think that went brilliantly well. We asked the public to vote on 100 innovations over the last century and another 12 that we thought would shape the coming century. We got something like, in 2 weeks, 90,000 people to take part, a third of a million page views. We had audio booths. These are little recordings of people like David Willetts. We did a lot on Twitter as well. The Prime Minister was tweeting on behalf of the Double Helix. We had 50,000 votes cast at the end of the day. And the last night, it was quite tense watching it unfold on Twitter as some very big hitters like Stephen Fry started agitating for the universal Turing machine. You had Jim Al-Khalili saying, no, vote for the quantum dot. I was backing metamaterials. We had huge groundswell of support for the Mallard, for the Mini. But at the end of the day, Stephen Fry and his mighty army of Twitter followers won it for the Universal Turing Machine, which is jolly nice for the museum because we've got a wonderful award-winning Turing exhibition as well. And in terms of the future-facing vote, the great British public, in fact, actually it was an international vote, I should say, but dominated by the UK, voted for Ionic Liquids in Belfast, which rather surprised me, but is a brilliant choice because this is a huge world-class, world-leading laboratory that even, you know, the heads of chemistry at MIT and the big American powerhouses of chemistry look enviously at what's happening in Belfast and say, we want one like that.
And are there any other direct ways in which you work with BIS?
We've had a really good relationship with BIS, and it's operated at various levels. So David Willits came in to the museum with the President of Brazil to sign a cooperation agreement, and we will be offering our expertise to the Brazilians to build a new science museum. We hosted the Make It in Great Britain exhibition, which is a fantastic showcase of British innovation. That was great as well. We mentioned the Great British Innovation Vote, where BIS is very helpful. We've had the first British ESA astronaut unveiled with the UK Space Agency in the museum. So lots of very fecund and fertile cross-fertilizations with BIS.
Your role is promoting academic and policy engagement. What exactly does that involve?
So yes, that's my role, and also I would say everyone's role in Government Office for Science. Our role is to bring the best scientific evidence to bear on policy. And you mentioned academia, but it's not just that, it's also industry and NGOs and things like that. So in terms of what it involves, well, the key technique we use, I suppose, is to use people. In particular, we maintain various networks across government. There's a network of chief scientific advisors that that sit in each of the government departments. There is a network of scientists and engineers called Government Science Engineering. There's about 3,500 members of that. And we also run specific projects. One that springs to mind is something we run with the Royal Society called the Pairing Scheme. And this pairs senior civil servants with expert academics in the field to try and encourage the interaction between the two groups. And we also work with bodies in universities that have a particular policy focus, such as the Centre for Science and Policy in Cambridge, Oxford Martin School, or the Policy Centre at UCL. So effectively, in Go Science, each person has a particular expertise, if you like, whether that's climate change, health, and they're the link point from the scientific evidence into the policy.
What would you like to see academics and policymakers doing more of?
Well, in a word, interacting. I mean, working with academics, you know, in particular, presents us with a number of advantages. They help policy, you know, academics can help policy decisions be based on the most up-to-date information. It can drive innovation by bringing, you know, new viewpoints, new external viewpoints, fresh perspectives, and sort of challenging that, I suppose, what you'd call groupthink. Obviously, academics take a very rigorous approach, so bring extra rigor to decisions, and possibly as well bring help bridge skills gaps. By bringing sort of a real, you know, a deep analytical approach to data-driven approach to problems, but there are, I think, you know, challenges when we talk about the interaction between academics and policymakers, and one of the things that comes up again and again are timescales. So quite often ministers will ask you, or, you know, as we know, questions get asked and answered typically in the space of a week, maybe by the time the next box is due, or a month, or maybe 9 months if there's a full consultation process. You know, even that longest parameter is quite a bit shorter than what, you know, an academic timescale for a big research project. So that's a challenge. There's another challenge, which is, I suppose, in terms of language. Academics tend to want to be extremely precise and ensure that any uncertainty in their answers is fully characterised and explained, whereas actually the reality of making decisions on a day-to-day basis in government means you need probably more certainty than any research can deliver. So there's a mismatch there.
Is there a link with the more open approaches being promoted through the government digital strategy?
Well, I think there definitely is. And there are probably two opportunities that I can see with that. One is that the government digital strategy and focus in the civil service reform plan on open policy making is a big opportunity to have more dialogue with the outside world, and that includes academics. There's a great example from our director in GoScience cites from time to time, which was a policy on care home reform, regulatory reform. And normally policy, you know, you get a consultation document, you put it online, you get comments from various interest groups back, and you try and build them in, and the process goes on. In this case, they posted the policy online. It was a wiki-style platform, and actual practitioners, got involved and got engaged, and you know, were debating with each other, and that just seemed to be a much more effective way of developing a neat policy. So, in terms of better policy, I think that's one opportunity for better dialogue. The second thing I would say is that I think there's an opportunity from a data perspective in that as more services are delivered digitally, that creates more, I suppose, management information that you can then analyse, and that gives you insights into which policies are and which services are being effective and which aren't.
How can individuals get involved?
Well, if you're a policymaker, I would say come and talk to the Government Office for Science, because we have extensive networks into academia. We've also got guidance on what to look, you know, methods of getting, of building up really good relationships with academics, and the things to look out for. If you're an academic, there are tons of opportunities to get involved with policy work. Responding to consultations, they're all on the gov.uk website. I'm sure at any one time there'll be many that have a scientific aspect. They are, you know, working with your learned society. They often have a policy arm and get involved in policy work. The research councils offer a huge number of secondments and policy placements. I know in GoScience we take on a number of secondments from BBSRC for their 3 months each, and we take a bunch of them each year. Always a great experience for both parties. You can bid for research directly, you know, via the gov.uk procurement website. I know DFID and DEFRA contract for a lot of research, for instance. You can work with think tanks. And again, the policy bodies that I mentioned earlier, like the Centre for Science and Policy and Oxford Martin, you know, they're good conduits into the policy world. So there really are tons of options. And that's not even, I mean, and that's just the government and civil service. There's the parliamentary side of things as well, and getting involved in inquiries, you know, just getting in touch with clerks and there are those avenues as well.
Thank you for listening to this month's podcast. Be sure to let us know your thoughts via Twitter. You can use the hashtag BizPodcast. Until next time, see you then.